Welcome back to Behind the Bars podcast. This week, I am joined by my brand new co-host, McKenna. I've known McKenna for almost a decade, and she'll be an amazing addition to our weekly program. This week, we'll be exploring the case of recently deceased rapist, killer, and lifelong criminal, Joseph Edward Duncan. We hope you enjoy. This is long overdue, but we're finally back recording episodes for Behind the Bars podcast. We are joined with McKenna, who is the new co-host.
Go ahead,
introduce yourself a little bit.
My name's McKenna. Do you go by Dalton or DB?
Either or.
Okay, sorry. I didn't want to like expose your name. I've known Dalton for what, like a decade now, almost?
Yeah.
It's been almost a decade. You know, we're both super huge true crime fans and kind of both fell back into it, I think, at a really similar time. He a little bit harder than me, but huge fans of true crime podcasts. And I feel so fortunate that I'm able to now be a part of one.
Welcome. So this week we are covering Joseph Edward Duncan. He actually just died, I believe it was last night. Yes, yesterday, from stage 4 brain cancer. He was born on February 25th, 1963 in Tacoma, Washington. Obviously died yesterday, which was March 28th, 2021. He was currently being held in the United States Penitentiary in Terre Haute, Indiana. He was a pretty big scumbag.
That's putting it so lightly.
I try to be a little nice.
He was a horrible scumbag. No, we're not going to be nice. This man was horrible. From the time that he was a child until the time that he died, this man was awful.
Yeah. So on his little snippet of a description here, he's a serial rapist, an arsonist, a serial killer, which he actually doesn't fit the criteria for a serial killer.
No, he doesn't.
A pedophile, a hebephile?
Hebephile. So that's later adolescent. So pedophile is obviously a child. Hebephile is somebody that's more attracted to adolescents, but still not, obviously not of consenting age, not of 17 in some cases, but 18 in others. So looking at someone who's more attracted to like 11 to 13 year olds.
What do you know? I almost have a degree in this and I still didn't know that.
Haha.
He's also, he was a family annihilator, a stalker, and an abductor. So he was a jack of all trades. He pretty much did it all. I said the only one I don't agree with is a serial killer, because if you look at the FBI criteria, he just doesn't fit.
Right. I want to know how they came to that. Like, obviously, family annihilator is what makes sense.
It doesn't. I mean, he did kill that one family, but
he killed the one family. So, I mean,
that's why I don't really
the one
feel
family, but I don't feel like serial killer fits that action.
I don't even know if I really agree with the family annihilator, because there's only one case. Now, if he went and did it for, you know, 10 different families, killed them all, okay, I'd be more inclined to say a family annihilator.
Yeah, we can stick that label on him.
Yeah. Modus operandi, which is his pretty much his calling card, was shooting. He only shot somebody once, which I don't really think it's his calling card. Bludgeoning, which he did to numerous of the victims.
Right.
Number of victims, it kind of varies. For victims he killed, 5 to 8, they're not all confirmed, because some of the cases he actually was not convicted. He had a couple cases in Washington. He confessed to it, but they never did get a conviction, because they were kind of more worried about the federal charge and the charges in Idaho and California. because they knew if they had him on those, there was no point to doing the California one because he was going to go to jail regardless.
Right. They were already putting him away for life. Washington. Yeah. They were already putting him away for life.
Yeah. Other than the kills, 3 to 16 rapes, which, like I said, it's going to vary because he kept changing his story numerous times throughout his life in the trial. 1 to 7 molestations, one attempted molestation.
That was, so there's a confirmed molestation of a little boy at a park. And then he, I think it's counted as one of the stalkings, stalked one of the little boy's friends and attempted to, I think was going, had intent to molest him as well, but didn't succeed.
All right. Span of crimes. He was in and out of prison. How many times we count? Six?
Six.
Six times between 1978 and 2005. He was in and out his entire life. There's two different reports. First one says his first sexual assault was actually when he was 12 years old. Another one says he was 15. We're not entirely sure which one, because there's only one place where I found the one from when he was 12, but it was a reputable source. So
right. But I think we can say his first recorded sex crime was at 15, because that was first one that he was convicted for. So whether or not he admitted to doing the one when he was 12, his first recorded sex crime is that one in 1978 in Tacoma. And that's when he raped a 9-year-old boy at gunpoint. Went to prison for that one for not long enough.
I agree.
He was promptly let out.
Yeah, we were talking before we started recording here, and literally this man kept getting let out. He was, you know, raping people, and then he's let out for good behavior. It's like, how can
the fact that he's raping and sodomizing little boys at gunpoint.
Yeah, and then we'll let you out.
Yeah, go back out. It's fine. Let's try it again, see what happens. And then he commits an onslaught of all these other different crimes as well, but they're like, oh, you'll do better this time. It's okay.
According to his brother, he was very manipulative and knew how to manipulate prison staff into letting him out.
Very evident.
Yes. The one he reminds me of is Kemper. Kemper was amazing at doing that.
Oh,
he still is.
Talker.
Yes, he is an incredibly intelligent man, and he can talk his way out of anything.
Yeah.
Criminal charges from 78 to 2005, he had almost 15 different charges. He had 5 counts of murder, 1 count of auto theft, 4 counts of kidnapping, 1 count of sodomy, 1 count of drug possession, and 1 count of parole violations. Which
is comical because he violated his parole 6 times.
Yeah.
Minimum, because he went back in 6 times. Well, he went back in 7 times, but what we counted was in and out for various violations of parole and various other crimes that committed while he should have been on parole.
Yeah. And if you're on parole and you get caught sodomizing and raping people, you probably shouldn't be given parole again.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's why I kind of like Texas. You have 3 strikes. You do it 3 times, you're in jail forever.
Yeah.
He got sentenced to death. He actually got 3 different federal charges to be sentenced for death. Count 1 was kidnapping and death. This was the first one he could actually be sentenced to death on in a federal court. Second one was sexual exploitation of a child resulting in death. Once again, they found him guilty, sentenced him to death. And third one was use of a firearm resulting in a death, which these were all from the same case. And they didn't get to execute him because he ended up dying beforehand. Total life charges with this man. He has some of the larger numbers I've seen. In Idaho, he had 6 life sentences. California, 2 life sentences. Then in federal court, he had 3 death sentences and 3 life sentences, which means there was not a shot in hell that this guy could ever get out.
Finally, they finally did it right.
Actually, there was one way he could get out. He'd have to appeal to the Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court was not going to let him out. So he didn't even bother.
Right.
Which is a good thing, because why waste the time when we know he's not going anywhere?
And hey, you know, he did have one way out, and it was to die. So congratulations, Mr. Duncan, you made it out of prison, sir.
He was going one way or another.
Exactly.
So when it comes to Duncan's younger parts of his life, it's very scattered in what we can find. And it also depends who you ask. So his brother, Bruce Duncan, claims that there was no abuse at all in the family. He'd never seen anything. I believe there were 5 kids in the family. And then we have his sister, Sherry Cox, who claims that there was frequent abuse by the mother. The mother would frequently rant that men were worthless. All they do is cause harm. The mother was described as a crazy woman who obsessively attended church daily, which I could see.
Yeah.
She claims if you fought back, the abuse would be worse. And Joseph would never fight back. He'd just take the abuse and then he'd go back to his room. So it's kind of weird that you have 2 people in the same exact family and they're saying complete different things. And I never saw anything from Joseph himself saying whether or not he was abused.
Right. I feel like given the crimes throughout his life, though, there has to be something. You know, nobody is brought up in a beautiful, loving household and then at 15 starts sodomizing boys at gunpoint.
Except serial killers. Yeah.
Well, except serial killers. But generally, there's at least a background there. So I feel like something happened.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, we fell, we got a concussion. There's a serial killer in the making. You know, we had some kind of abuse. Something had to have happened to make Duncan the way that he was.
Yeah, but there are, like I said, there are killers that they just snapped one day. They had a great family, and then they start murdering people.
True.
We don't know why.
True. But I feel like what we see in Duncan is a progression.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah,
it's not like you said, where, you know, with some of these guys, they just snap. With him, we see raping, sodomizing, steal a car, rape and sodomizing, and now we're going to massacre a family.
Yeah.
You know, like that, we've escalated a bit.
And the fact that he's been doing it literally from 1978 until he got arrested in 2005.
Right.
So I'm curious how many cases we didn't know about. Because there had to be more, because that's really all he ever did with his life was
right
sexually assault young boys.
Fortunately, there was a 14-year break where they did actually keep him in jail, because he was sentenced to 20 years at one point and then got out after 14. So blissfully, there was a 14-year break where he wasn't actually killing or sodomizing anybody, which is great.
Yes, very much so. So the sister actually left home at 17. Which I believe she was a couple years older than him, if I remember correct. And she only saw him one time after that in her entire life, which was actually when he was in a Washington psych hospital. Didn't say why he was there, when he was there, anything like that. But that's the only time she ever saw him after she left home. So it's weird that she'd come back, you know, once his crime came out, then she magically shows up again.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah. The brother, however, has no sympathy for Joseph at all. He claims that his brother is not a monster. He is a human being and he has feelings, but he doesn't value human life, which he's proven time and time again with, you know, all the murders, sexual assaults, yada, yada, yada. He claims he has no pity for my brother or for what he did. I feel sorry for the family that he destroyed. So he was totally cool with his brother being sentenced to death because he deserved it, which
valid.
Yeah. But to get a family that, you know, says, yep, he deserves it. That's pretty rare. Usually they try to defend him somewhat.
Right. Usually they'll stand by them until the end. But I mean, I think with how horrific his crimes were, I don't think there's a way that you can, even with it being your brother, stand behind that and say, no, he's still a great guy. No, he's not.
Yeah. So in 1980, he was released from prison. Mm-hmm. I lied. He was not released from prison. I was reading the wrong thing. So in 1980, he stole a bunch of guns from his neighbor and abducted a 14-year-old boy and proceeded to rape him at gunpoint.
Yep.
That was when
he was sentenced to 20 years. Yep.
Correct. So once he got out on parole 14 years later, which was 94, he bounced around the Seattle area, odd jobs, living here and there, nothing real, never really did anything with himself. 2 years later, in 96, he was arrested again for marijuana use, which, not really a big deal.
Right.
Released on parole, a bunch of, what,
several weeks later. Yeah.
New restrictions but saying, then, hey, don't do this again.
Well, right. Really, which I mean, fine. Slap on the wrist for weed, like whatever.
Yeah.
However, what's so messed up is that this is when they believe that Duncan murdered two people in Seattle, Semiejo White and Carmen Cubias.
Yeah.
And then went on to California and committed the Martinez murder.
Correct.
Both of the cases went cold until he was positively identified in the Martinez murder later on. I think in August 3rd, 2005, the sheriff officially announced Duncan's connection with the Martinez case.
Yeah. And that was after he murdered the Gronies.
Yes. That was when he was already incarcerated at that point.
So it's crazy that he went for what, 8 years without anything for that? I mean, obviously they thought it was him, but
right,
they couldn't prove it.
The Martinez case is just so, like, so sad. This young boy playing with his friends out front of his house, he's approached by a strange man asking about a lost cat. And that's the last anyone sees of Martinez for 2 weeks. April 19th, he's found nude, partially decomposed, evidence of sexual assault. He was bound with duct tape. And that poor young boy's family had to wait until 2005 to find out who had murdered him. Like, that, it's just such an upsetting case.
Yeah. And especially when they had a sketch of the suspect and a partial fingerprint.
Right.
So
of a man who has already been in prison half a dozen times at this point.
Exactly. How, I guarantee he'd been fingerprinted every time. So
right.
How did, I mean, obviously partial fingerprints can be numerous people. I get that, but you know.
And unfortunately, we're also dealing in the late 90s, early 2000s, where were jurisdictions really talking to each other, because he's in Riverside when he was just in Seattle. You know, he did a really good job of bouncing around and not staying in one place. And at that point, you know, the news wasn't as easy as it was now to click and find anything happening in the country. So I'm sure that really aided in him not being caught at that point, because they just weren't communicating. They didn't see a link at that point.
I did find it really interesting that the only way that he was linked to that is a bunch of bloggers actually saw similarities between him and the composite sketch.
I love that. Yeah, I love a good internet sleuth when they're like actually accurate.
Yeah.
I think a solid internet sleuth does amazing things.
And the fact that, you know, the FBI actually took it serious and did, okay, let's check this out, and then they matched the fingerprint to him. That's
phenomenal.
Yes. The fact that it took 8 years was a little disappointing, but
yeah.
And then in 2005, on July 19th, he actually confessed to that murder, and he described the crime as a revenge against society for sending him back to jail for a probation violation. Well, sure. You know, when you break parole or probation, you go back to jail. That's just kind of how it goes.
Well, let's maybe not take it out on young boys.
Yeah, you know, or maybe you. Just you not. It. Yeah, maybe not rape young boys to begin with. Well, that's kind of an easy thing, but clearly he's him and doesn't.
Not an option for him.
Yeah.
So after that, he returns to prison in 97 for the violation of parole, released in 2000 for good behavior, and moves to where? Fargo, North Dakota. Fargo can't get a break, man.
They really can't. That I feel bad for them up there.
So then in 2005, so we made it 5 years, he's charged with the July 3rd, 2004 molestation of two boys in Detroit Lakes, Minnesota. And this is the weird part, and maybe you found more information on this than I did. A Fargo businessman helped him post bail.
Who is that
man, and why did he do that?
I guess somehow they became acquainted before that. So I don't know if he was one of the people that Joseph did side work for or helped out, you know, here and there. But obviously he.
But I'm sorry, even if you got a buddy doing side work for you, like if I found out that, like, my buddy who's doing side work molested two little boys, like, I'm not posting his bail.
Exactly.
Maybe that's my morals.
Or that he keeps breaking his parole and whatnot over and over and over. It's like,
right?
Why would you vouch your money? I mean, he came up with what? Bail was $15,000.
Yeah.
So usually 10%. So $1,500. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to pay $1,500 to get an acquaintance out of jail.
Absolutely not. And then even better, he gets out and he ghosts, which, I mean, smart, but like this guy posts his bail and then he's like, peace, I'm out. And then he winds up getting a federal warrant issued for his obviously unlawful flight to avoid persecution. And that was less than a year before the Groney murders. So he got out, he went to Idaho and went berserk.
Yeah, he really did bounce around quite a bit. You know, we have Idaho, we have California, we have North Dakota, we have, where else was he?
Washington.
I mean, thankfully he kind of bounced around up there and he didn't really come over any further.
Right.
But it was weird that he kept going back to the same spot. It's like, clearly this isn't working out.
Right. Clearly we had like a stomping ground and maybe we needed to not do that anymore.
Yeah. But you know, after six times, why not? Maybe the seventh will work out.
Ugh.
So tell us about the Groney murders.
Oh, okay. Here we go. May 26, 2005 in Kootenai County, Idaho. The bodies of Brenda Groney, 40, her boyfriend, Mark McKenzie, 37, her son, Slade Groney, 13, were discovered in their home along, you told me how to say this, Lake Coeur d'Alene?
Coeur d'Alene. Which it strikes me odd that Slade was not kidnapped as well.
Right. Why was Slade left?
Yeah, because it never really said why, but I mean, he liked the young ones and then,
right,
as you explained, he liked the teens. I don't know if, you know, just
I feel like Dylan and Shasta were probably just more his flavor, or he realized he could only handle two and not three.
True.
It could have just been a logistics thing of if I'm going to go and torture and rape and molest children for however long until I'm done, like I can probably only do two. I think what really messes me up is he didn't kill Shasta.
Yeah.
I don't understand that. But anyway, we're getting ahead of ourselves. So the bodies of Brenda, Mark, and Slade all found dead in their home. Homicides were deemed to be blunt force trauma to the head. And then Dylan, age 9, and Shasta, age 8, were missing. This is hard to read. Here we go. Duncan, wearing black gloves and holding a gun, zip-tied the mother's hands as well as the mother's fiancé and brother that we slayed. Dylan and Shasta were placed inside a stolen rental car where all they heard was screaming while Duncan bludgeoned the three to death. Dylan and Shasta were taken to other locations where they were molested for 6 weeks and stayed at multiple campsites while Duncan told Shasta how he had beaten her family to death with a hammer. Dylan's remains were found in a remote woodland area after she was recovered. On July 4th, 2005, investigators found human remains at a campsite near Lolo National Forest, which were positively identified as Dylan. I just saw it. Sorry. Hold on. I have to find the thing about the Denny's. Oh, July 2nd, 2005. Shasta is seen in a man's custody at a Denny's. Two customers recognized her and called the police while preventing Duncan from leaving, where he was later arrested without incident and finally went into custody for the last time.
Yeah, the whole ordeal with the cabins was that was actually one of the things he got sentenced to death for. Because there's actually something called the cabin video, which I didn't look into too much because
I didn't either. It's out there, though, and I know that you can find it. But he recorded everything.
Yes.
He videotaped everything that he did to Dylan and Shasta. I think up to and including Dylan's murder.
Yes, which that's something they should have locked away and never let out. I mean, obviously, you have to let out in court. After that, it should have been hidden forever, because now we have Shasta, who's still alive from what I read.
Yes,
she does.
She is still alive to this day.
You know, it's bad enough that she went through this and saw, well, first she saw him try to murder her brother, and Duncan put a shotgun to his head, pulled the trigger, but it failed to go off. Obviously, being a kid, he begged Duncan not to kill him. He reloaded the shotgun, put it back to the boy's head, pulled the trigger, and it went off this time. So definitely, and this is after, what'd you say, 7 weeks or 6 weeks of being tortured and molested. That's that's ridiculous. This guy definitely deserved what he got in the end. Yeah. Terrible, terrible people.
For real.
And then Duncan claims that, well, after he killed Dylan, he started crying and told Shasta that he only killed him to put him out of his misery. And he also at one point was telling Shasta that it was an accident. He didn't mean for the gun to go off and kill him.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's totally believable when you did it twice.
Yeah. And then after Dylan was murdered, Shasta actually reported that Duncan nearly killed her a couple days after killing Dylan. She said that he gave her the choice to either be killed by strangulation or with a gun, and she chose to be strangled. And when Duncan proceeded to wrap a rope around her neck and pull it tight, he couldn't do it. Shasta begged Duncan to stop using his nickname Jet, and immediately he stopped. He started crying and then asked if he would like to meet his mother, which is really weird. I mean, you're molesting and murdering these kids, and, oh, hey, do you want to meet my mom?
Right.
What the fuck are you thinking?
Well, and also, I really, again, wish I could have been inside his head and see what caused that break.
Yeah.
What was it about Shasta that you couldn't, like, I'm so grateful for her. I'm so happy for her that, like, something, he saw something in her that he just couldn't eliminate. And that is so wonderful for her. But, like, what was it after all these kids that you have hurt, after murdering her entire family, and you have abused her for 6 weeks now, why at this point can you not do it?
Yeah. And the fact that she agreed to it was probably the best decision she made, because it got him to drive back to Coeur d'Alene, which is eventually where they got caught. They stopped at a Denny's, and that's where she was recognized, and mm-hmm. he was taken into custody. I mean, that's one of the smartest things that she could have done. And it does strike me as odd that, you know, he really hasn't said anything about abuse, but sister claims, you know, she was horribly abusive, yet he wants to bring this young girl to meet her.
Right. Like, what are you inviting there? What are you inviting or implying? Like, what's the rationale?
Clearly he's not mentally competent. I mean, I know I was reading one of his, what do I want to call it? One of his attorneys that he had even questioned his mental state. They said he would go in and out. He'd be sane, and then all of a sudden he'd be talking gibberish and go completely off in a different direction. But yet
it makes it even more comical that he was deemed competent. Yes. Because on April 14th, 2008, during his trial, he dismissed his attorneys, like, you know, a totally sane person does, and offered to represent himself. And then, of course, had an evaluation to determine his competency and his ability to represent himself. And they determined that he was indeed competent enough to represent himself in a quadruple homicide.
Yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah. And before he was tried federally, the attorney he did have didn't even try to get him off on saying, hey, he's not mentally competent. Didn't even try it. It's like, you would think that would kind of be one of the first things they would try, because
right,
that's where these first things always go. It's, oh, well, they're, you know, criminally insane, or they're not mentally competent, which...
Right, and they didn't even try an insanity plea with him. They tried every other plea in the book.
I think that was something that Joseph didn't want.
Right.
I mean, clearly he wasn't all there, and he probably shouldn't have been, but they just kept proceeding anyway. With what he did, I don't think they were going to give him any chance to get out of it.
No.
Which... I don't blame them at all. The federal judge was quoted saying during the trial, in 31 years of being involved in the criminal justice system, I have never met a more evil person than Joseph Duncan. Which, to have a federal judge that's been doing it for 31 years to say something that extreme.
That's impressive.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, I mean, granted, it's one in Idaho, but still, that's insane.
Yeah.
And then
I also like, just a fun tidbit, I love that Arnold Schwarzenegger got involved in this case.
Did he really?
Yeah. Well, because he was the then governor of California and they were trying to extradite him to California for the Martinez case. And so Arnold Schwarzenegger did an appeal to get him extradited to California. But I don't think it even went through. The federal trial proceeded. And then eventually he was extradited to California 5 months after being sentenced to death by the federal court. Right?
I got nothing on that one.
Like, fun fact, like, you're so horrible that even Arnold Schwarzenegger's like, bring him here.
Yeah.
So we can get him. Like.
So he had a blog online, which I'm assuming somebody else was writing. He would write it. He would send it out. They'd upload it. Before he died, he claimed that he was waiting for his release day, which is execution, obviously. Which is kind of weird to label it as that, but he knew he wasn't going anywhere.
Right.
I mean, he was done for. Obviously, he was being held in a federal prison, which was actually in Terre Haute. And this is actually the same prison that is going to be housing the Boston City Bomber shortly here. And it's actually where the Oklahoma City Bomber, Timothy McVeigh, was executed in 2001.
Ah.
Which, I'm kind of shocked they're moving the Boston City Bomber there, because usually they keep the really high profile like him in Colorado.
Right.
Because they keep them with, you know, El Chapo and actually I think the Unabomber's still in Colorado too.
The Unabomber is still there. Yeah.
Yeah. And believe it or not, the same guy who was the attorney for the Unabomber was this guy's attorney before he dismissed them.
Huh.
Yeah. So this guy had taken the high profile cases before, and I'm pretty sure he knew he'd make bank on this, but obviously he was gotten rid of. So
missed by the ever so obviously very competent and intelligent Joseph Duncan.
Yeah. So he was sentenced to death in 2005 by lethal injection, yet there was never a date set to execute him. So the fact that 16 years went by and we didn't have a date to kill him.
That's so weird. And this is after he, because it was appeal after appeal after appeal.
It was, but he refused it. He didn't want to appeal because he waived his right to fight the death sentence. And I mean, the attorneys tried to appeal and he said no. He's like,
right.
And then he did kind of have a change in that later on, though, because in March, when it was revealed that he had cancer, they tried to appeal again to get him out, kind of a compassionate release, which.
Mm.
No. Obviously does not shouldn't be out. He doesn't deserve that.
I wonder, like, because obviously you don't develop terminal brain cancer overnight. I wonder if there wasn't some indication that he was getting ill and they were like, we know that this cancer is going to take him out, so let's not even spend tax dollars on executing him.
Yeah, because they claim they found it. Yeah, they found it in early 2002 because he had brain surgery in October of 2002.
Okay.
They didn't really go into what the brain surgery was exactly, but obviously it was cancer and he's not going to live.
Right. So we knew in 2002 and then he was arrested for the Groney murders in 2005. So he was already 3 years into growing whatever he was growing.
Oh, sorry, not 2002, 2020. I can't read.
Oh,
my bad.
I was like, dang, he had this 3 years before. Gosh, yeah, man, no. He's really getting around.
And then a month after his brain surgery, the medical staff with the Federal Bureau of Prisons actually told him that he has 6 to 12 months to live.
Oh, which, yeah,
pretty good guess. He lasted five.
Oh,
I mean, that's pretty solid. Spot on.
Solid, yeah.
So they actually, I found a snippet on Shasta Groney, who is the only survivor of any of his crimes. She, I can't remember when this was written off the top of my head here. This was written in 2015, so it's a little old, but at this point she was 18 years old, and it's reported that obviously, she's having difficulty. She's had run-in with police and quite a bit of time in juvenile treatment, which, not surprising. I mean, she experienced these horrific things. I don't think that she will ever, I mean, she may live a somewhat normal life, but I don't think it'll ever be,
no,
quote unquote, you know, a normal one. That, okay, what, yeah, it should be.
She'll never be normal. And I don't think you can be when you've undergone that kind of trauma at such a young age.
Yeah. I know the sergeant for the Kootenai County Sheriff's Department who took care of this, he still, to this day, says, I don't think a day will ever go by that I'm not thinking about the case and the videos, referring to the cabin videos that they had to watch.
The videos, I know, really were horrible for the investigating officers. It scarred a lot of them.
He actually thought it was a prank that he was being called in the night that they found Shasta, because it was his 50th birthday and he had it off, and they called him saying, hey, there's a report of multiple murders. And he's like, yeah, okay.
Whatever.
Turned out it's going to be one of the worst calls that he had in his entire career.
Oh, that's miserable.
Yeah. And he was the same guy that got called when they found her at Denny's, which, according to this, was at 2 a.m. So he got a call at 2 a.m., woke him up saying, oh, hey, by the way, the guy that kidnapped her, yeah, he has her at Denny's.
Right. And he put her in the bathroom.
Yeah.
He didn't say that. He walks in. There's two young men that are standing outside smoking. One of them recognized him from, or I think recognized Shasta from like a missing persons billboard. Alerted the employees inside. But in that time, Duncan puts Shasta in the bathroom and then comes out. And at that point is detained by the people in the restaurant. Police arrive shortly after, and Shasta is still in the bathroom. I don't know if he locked her in or just told her to stay there, but for some reason, instead of being a normal human and sitting down at a table with her, he put her in the bathroom.
I think he knew something was up.
Right.
Because obviously when people start looking at you like that, there's something going on.
That's true. That's true. So, I'm sure he heard whispers.
Yeah. So like I said, thankfully he is no longer with us. He totally deserved what he got. I don't wish brain cancer on anyone, but, well.
But if anyone deserved it, it's Joseph Duncan.
Absolutely. So, thankfully, we don't have to house him or pay to feed him or pay for his medical treatments. Because I can guarantee we paid for his brain surgery.
Oh, absolutely.
Which, like we said, why are we doing this life-saving surgery on you when you're going to die anyway? We're literally putting you to death.
No sense.
Yeah. At that point, move the date up. Well you're not going to make it. Well, we'll take care of you.
There's a really lovely quote just to end off with. It's Anthony Martinez's younger brother, Marcos, was quoted yesterday saying, nothing can bring my brother back, but now Duncan can never hurt anyone again. Because of him, I will spend the rest of my life doing everything I can to fight against any evil left in the world.
I like it.
Right.
All right, well, thanks everyone for your listen. We will actually have, who are we covering next week? I know you picked him. I can't remember.
Oh, we talked about it. He's the top Kansas, one on your list.
Kansas City Butcher, I believe. Which is Robert Berdella, which is another crazy case.
Yes.
So we will be back next week with him.
All right, we'll see you all next week. Until then, stay safe.